Chapter 17. 1947. At home in Shacklehurst, Eleanor could not settle. Was it time to stop pressing her old friend Steve Warren to help her protect a young couple and their child, a family who, to be honest, she was barely acquainted with, though she knew enough about them? When she reflected upon the speed with which she had acted out of sheer anger, it unsettled her. She had been at the mercy of an intense reaction running through every fibre of her being. There was nothing considered about her response, no thought, no weighing up of what might or might not happen, or the lack of power she had in a world of which she knew precious little, the librarian in Tunbridge Wells notwithstanding. The nearest she had come to black markets, the doping of horses and dogs, smash-and-grab raids, shoplifting, and anything else that occurred to the criminal mind, was catching out the local butcher, shafting his customers. But she knew all about secrecy and sleight of hand, so she had jumped into the fire with an idealistic belief that she could save Jim, Rose, and, most important, little Susie. Now she was stumped. Yes, she knew the Mackey family was steeped in an underworld of rackets, a never-ending game of risk and chance, passed from father to sons, with enviable profits and a strong balance sheet to feather a growing number of nests every single year. The war had been good for operators like the Mackeys, and it seemed even Scotland Yard was picking its battles with organised crime. As Charlie Kettle said to her once in passing, "It's like any other game where the players are matched. You win some, you lose some." In Belgium, through two wars, she had only ever lost one battle, and in this case, perhaps the best thing would be to step away and reconstitute her quiet life. It was a life she was grateful to have, so many had lost theirs. There were other ways she could be a good, caring neighbour to Jim, Rose, and Susie, especially Susie. She could leave the bigger Mackey problem to those who understood the nature of organised crime in a world where the darkness of war hadn't yet lifted. Such thoughts came and went as the day passed, lingering on her lack of personal control and a visceral memory of the rush of fury she felt when she saw Rose and Susie outside the cottage where Jim's brothers were pushing him to return to his former life. It was a smouldering anger she could still feel burning away in her gut, and the only way she knew to keep it from flaring again was the physicality of working in her garden, pulling away weeds, time and again steeping her ungloved hands in the soil to ground the live, sparking wire she had become. When dusk began to envelop the fields beyond the kitchen garden, the waning sun spread a mellow terracotta glow across the land, as if with nature's artistry a bucket of deep orange wash had been thrown across the horizon. She scrubbed her hands at the kitchen sink before picking up her binoculars to scan the fence line on either side of the field, looking for movement along the perimeter of the woodland beyond. Nothing. She moved her attention to the path, flanking the hedge to the right. Again, nothing. She put the binoculars away in the drawer where she had placed the Webley and once again stared at the horizon. A sudden knocking at the door startled her with its ferocity. It sounded as if the caller was banging with fists while calling out to her, screaming her name. A child was wailing.
"Miss White! Miss White, are you there? Miss White, please come! Please be there!"
Eleanor ran to the door, drew back the locks, as Rose Mackey put all her weight on the other side to gain entry faster. Clutching her screaming daughter, she burst into the house.
"Rose, what's the matter? Tell me."
Rose drew breath to speak, but instead began to cough. Her face flushed and her eyes reddened. Susie was crying, rivulets of tears and mucus rolling into her mouth. Eleanor pulled a fresh handkerchief from her sleeve and wiped the child's face as her mother struggled to breathe, panic overwhelming her.
"Here, let me hold her for you," said Eleanor,
reaching for Susie, who accepted the open arms as if her own mother could never more be trusted.
"Sit down, Rose. Take another deep breath, that's it, and another. Now, talk to me. Tell me what's happened." "They came again, his brothers, two of them, Bobby and Sandy," She rested her hand on her chest. I took Susie into the kitchen, popped her in the high chair while I put on the kettle so I could give them a cup of tea. Then I heard all this yelling. Only it was Jim doing the shouting, telling them they could take their... that they could take their effing plan and shove it. He was screaming at them that he was finished with their rotten jobs and he was finished with the family altogether.
Rose gasped to catch her breath.
I went in there, thinking I could say something to settle him down. I'd never seen him like that. He's usually so calm. And there he was going for Sandy. And no one goes for Sandy if they want to stay alive.
She took another deep breath.
He told me to run. So I grabbed Susie and came over to you. I didn't know where else to go.
Eleanor's decision was instant. Stay here. She settled Susie on her mother's lap. Help yourself to anything you need. Just try to quiet yourself, Rose. She ran to the kitchen, took her old gardening jacket from a hook behind the door and put it on. She reached into the cutlery drawer for the semi-automatic pistol and shoved it into her pocket before returning to the sitting room. Do not follow me. Is that clear?
But, Miss White, they're horrible men. Violent. You don't know what they're like.
And they don't know what I'm like either. So the playing field is even. Now, stay here. Whatever you do, don't follow me, because I might not be able to protect Jim if I have to worry about you too. Eleanor left the house and ran down the road, slowing as she made her way in silence along the side of the Mackey's cottage. The dog was leashed to a tree and already barking, so any escalation of the creature's howling fury when Eleanor reached the back of the dwelling would not herald the arrival of a stranger. The lights were on in the cottage. From a side window, she could see Jim Mackey on the floor of the small beamed sitting room. One man was leaning over him, pinning him down, and then kicking him with feet, clad in heavy workman's boots. The other man looked on, his back to the kitchen door, his arms folded while he gave orders and watched.
Do we have to start all over again, Jimmy boy? Because the way you're going, you will be dead by the time we've finished.
Eleanor moved toward the kitchen door at the rear of the house, opened it without discernible sound, and stepped into the cottage. The curtains at windows facing the road had been drawn, so no one passing could witness what was happening inside. The man giving orders had his back to her, the other looking down at Jim Mackey, whose eyes were closed tight as he braced for the next blow, the next kick or punch. She had no choice but to make her entrance. Eleanor stepped into the sitting room behind the man standing with folded arms. She lifted the gun, moved her forefinger from the barrel to the trigger and held the pistol to his neck.
If you stir one muscle, one at all, I will kill you. Do not doubt me, because I have killed men far more powerful than you will ever be.
She felt the man brace and pressed the weapon deeper into his flesh.
I said, do not doubt me. And above all, do not speak, because there is nothing you can say that I have the patience to hear.
She waited a second.
Good. We all know the name of the game. Now you, thug with the boots, stand away from Mr. Mackey. Put your hands above your head where I can see them and stand by the door. Go no farther until I tell you. One error, and your brother, this one, will be dead before you've touched that gun strapped to your left ankle. As will you.
The man edged away from Jim Mackey and stepped toward the door, where he appeared about to turn.
Do not look at me, warned Eleanor. Remain absolutely still and do not move.
She took a breath.
Jim, can you stand and walk?
Just about, miss.
That's enough. No need to say more unless I ask a question. Go to your brother by the door and remove his gun and the knife. I believe it's strapped to the other ankle. Then come back and take away this one's Luger. It's bound to be a Luger from the holster underneath the left flap of his jacket. Oh, and please, sir, again, don't move, because I'm awfully fast. Though today I might be clumsy, miss your neck, and go straight for your brain.
Jim followed Eleanor's instructions.
Good. Jim, walk quickly back through the kitchen and around to the front of the house. Check the motor car outside. You'll know where to find their armory. And start the engine for them, because they're leaving now, and I'm sure they want to be on their way back to Mickleham Street.
When Jim Mackey left the room, Eleanor instructed the brother by the door to open it and emerge onto the front step and no farther, at which point she followed,
her gun still fast against the neck of the one she suspected was a possible future patriarch of the Maki tribe.
"So far so good, gentlemen," said Eleanor. "I must say, you're much easier to deal with than the Nazis. Now, I think we know what to do next."
Jim Mackey stepped away from the idling motor car as the brother who had kicked him in every part of his body and blackened his face with bruises slipped into the driver's seat. Eleanor did not relinquish the pistol's pressure on the first brother's neck until he was seated.
"Your business is of no interest to me, but know this. If I see you on this road or anywhere near my friends again, I will hunt you down and I will end your sorry lives. Never let it enter your heads that I could not or would not keep my promise."
Eleanor slammed the door and watched the Ford Pilot with its 3-litre engine depart at speed, skidding around the corner and into the night.
"Miss White, she turned to Jim Mackey. "Jim, I know what you're going to say. You're about to warn me that they will be back, and when they get here, it will be team-handed, with as many men as they can muster. I also know they will have paid off any policeman who might try to stop them on the way for driving after dark. With that in mind, you must leave as soon as you can."
But we've nowhere to go."
"I know. That's why I have a safe place for you. They'll find your house. They'll know."
"Of course they will. Come on. I dare say they will stop in the village to use the telephone kiosk, then wait until their cavalry arrives. So after they've made their call to arms, I would estimate we have 2 hours at the outside."
"Now we're the ones driving off to dark and breaking the law. Where are we going, Miss White?"
Jim Mackey was next to Eleanor in the passenger seat. In the back of the motor car, Susie was sleeping in her mother's arms. The scruffy dog, who Eleanor had discovered was in fact named Scruff, leaned against Rose's shoulder.
"To the home of a friend of mine. She's expecting us. That's who I was placing a call to when we stopped in Flimwell."
"Does she live alone?"
"Yes, but the houses are close together and she knows her neighbours."
"They'll find out who your friends are, Miss White."
Eleanor laughed. "Not this one. Anyway, I'm sure they know all about me already. And then it might occur to them that I'm acquainted with a few people who are rather like me, people I can call upon in times of trouble."
"Come in, come in. Put your bag down anywhere. Jim, Rose and Susie, isn't it? And this must be Scruff. Welcome. I'm sure you'd like a nice hot bath and then go to bed."
Sophie stood alongside the open door to her Georgian house on the outskirts of Burwash in Sussex.
"But first let's feed you. I know time is getting on, but you'll sleep better after some hot soup. Don't go to bed on an empty stomach, that's my motto. It's chicken with vegetables, I hope you like it. And I'll put down some mashed bread and gravy for your dog. Best I can do for her until tomorrow, I'm afraid."
"Thank you, Sophie," said Eleanor, reaching out to embrace her friend.
"It's very kind of you, Mrs. Hunt. I don't know what to..."
Jim Mackey might have appeared to blush were his face not bathed in bruises, now more livid and purple since embarking upon the journey.
"Young man, a friend of Eleanor's is a friend of mine. Now then, let's get this dear little girl settled. I've put you in the guest room upstairs. It already has a cot in it. It's old-fashioned and well past its prime, but I found it in the attic, a leftover from my childhood. I kept it because you never know when something like that will come in handy for friends visiting with a small child."
Sophie turned to Eleanor.
"Will you show Rose where the bathroom is while I put out the soup? Oh, and you'll find the first aid kit in the downstairs WC, handy for when I've done something silly to myself in the garden. There's some tincture to treat nasty bruises in the box."
The exhausted Mackey family said little beyond expressions of gratitude and were in bed soon after eating, and Eleanor hoped sleeping off the ordeal.
"You don't look so chipper yourself, Linny," said Sophie, as she handed Eleanor a generous measure of brandy in a crystal snifter.
"I expected Jim's brothers to pay another visit, and I knew that when it came, it would be more violent than the first. It was lucky I was there to help out." Sophie sipped her brandy and sat back in the armchair.
"You told me a little on the telephone, but do you want to talk about it?"
Eleanor shook her head. It's a long story.
Probably not that long. I think you just don't want to tell it.
Sophie sighed, swirled her brandy in the balloon glass, sipped again and leaned forward. Eleanor braced herself.
Linny, I've hardly seen you in 3 years, since 1944. This is only the second time you've been to my house. You came for a few days after the hospital discharged you, and then you retreated to the flat for a while until you moved down to Kent. I've been hoping for an invitation to your cottage since you sent me the address.
She took another sip, set her glass on a side table and returned her attention to Eleanor.
Look, neither of us wants to talk about what we did in the war. We avoided it like the plague when you were here before, and it's more than we dare do. But if you told me that nothing happened to break your heart, I know you would be lying. Everyone's heart was broken. David was already with the RAF when war was declared. He was so excited when he received the transfer to 617 Squadron. Because of my job, I know exactly where it happened and what he was doing. I can't stand it when I hear people talk about the Ruhr Dam and how thrilling it was that we destroyed part of the thing. So much for the we. I lost my husband.
She sighed and took another sip.
I know this much, Linny. There's something more to this story than just a local family you want to protect. The child is quite a charmer, isn't he?
Sophie, there is nothing to tell you, really. There are no big secrets, apart from the fact that you and I both have secrets, as you said. And as for the trio upstairs, yes, perhaps you've a point. I feel an affection for them. Jim was no saint in his early years, though coming from the Mackey family, it's hardly surprising, is it? But they are a lovely little unit, and, again, as you've said, we've seen so much heartbreak that I wanted to try to stop it touching Jim, Rose, and Susie.
All right. It's one of your weaker excuses, though I'll accept it because it's better than nothing. But here's the thing that bothers me.
Sophie sighed, her gaze drawn across the room to a photograph on the wall of her late brother and sister. Eleanor recognized the look. She had seen it one day in Kensington Gardens, when Sophie stared toward the place where her brother had trained in a Royal Park's make-believe trenches. A simulation that would be nothing like the real thing.
The part that bothers me, Eleanor, Sophie continued, is that these people you're getting mixed up with are killers. Even the police who are after them are killers. And I guessed long ago, Linny, that you also had to do your bit in that department. But if you put yourself up against that lot, there is going to be a very, very bad ending.
She shrugged and reached out to take her friend's hand. I just don't want the bad ending to be yours. Eleanor looked down into the brandy glass, still held in her other hand. Tired and distracted in the moment, she began thinking how much the colour and movement of liquid in the glass resembled the evening sunset across golden fields, a source of wonder in her world only minutes before a knock at the door changed everything. She lifted the glass to her lips, wincing and gripping Sophie's hand as she swallowed against the bite of brandy at her throat.
Sophie, I've already had one very bad ending. I'm trying hard not to have another.
Jim Mackey remained at the kitchen table after a breakfast prepared by Sophie and Eleanor, who did their best to entertain with old stories of the terrible food endured at school, which they maintained had prepared them for the rationing that was to come when war broke out again. Soon, though, Sophie declared she had to prepare for several days of lectures at the university and some other work in London, during which time she would be staying at the flat she and her husband had bought before the war. The house in Burwash, she explained, had been her family home. She inherited it when her parents died.
I'll be away for a night or two, but you must stay here. I'll show you and Rose where to find everything. I've let the gardener and my daily, Mrs. Moss, know that I have guests staying, so they won't be coming in this week.
But Mrs. Hunt, Rose and me, we don't want you to go to all this trouble.
Eleanor looked at the exhausted man, at his swollen face. Jim, you have no other choice but to stay here. You cannot return to the cottage.
I'm driving back to my house later this morning, so I will stop at the farm and explain to Mr. Wicks that you have been taken poorly after a fall. And you'll be returning to work in a few days. I will vouch for you.
We don't know my family. It won't be over in a few days.
One step at a time, Jim, counseled Eleanor. Just one step at a time. Now they were alone, Sophie having repaired to her study while Rose carried Susie out into the garden to play.
Miss White, I can see you know how to look after yourself, but really, you should stay away too. They'll come for you.
Eleanor nodded. Let me deal with it, Jim. And it's better sooner rather than later. She poured more tea for them both and pushed the sugar bowl toward Jim. He shook his head.
I gave it up because it was easier than cutting down. I dunno, things are getting worse, not better, aren't they? What with the butter and meat ration being cut again, and the war's been over for 2 years. They say the bacon ration will be halved by this autumn. One thing about being a farm worker, you get an extra cheese ration.
He gave a half laugh.
Which is just as well, because Susie does like her cheese.
Eleanor agreed about the ration situation, encouraging an easing of conversation to a point where she could ask a few more pertinent questions.
You know, we went up to London on the train in February, said Jim. I took a day off that was owing to me, so we thought we'd go to that exhibition the papers were going on about. It was called Britain Can Make It. I thought it would be a bit of a tonic, you know, doing things other people do for a bit of fun. Then all we heard was people saying, Britain can make it, it should be called Britain Can't Take It. The papers were full of it, and I started to wonder, you know, if perhaps the war wasn't worth winning. The countries that lost have come off rationing, and the likes of my so-called family up there in London are still making a fortune on the black market.
He wiped the back of his hand across his eyes.
You know, all I ever wanted was to go straight.
I know that, Jim.
The war gave me a chance, and I came out of the army with a clean slate. My record was clean. I met Rose when I was stationed in London. And when we had Susie, we knew it was time to get away from the smoke, get away from where I was brought up.
He leaned forward, elbows on the table.
You know, people think the world of my family and our part of London. They think the good old Mackies are keeping the streets clean of filth that the police don't care about or can't get rid of. But from London Bridge down to Greenwich, the boroughs south of the river are like a crime-infested swamp.
Tears filled his eyes again.
And the swamp followed me and did this to my family, and all we wanted was quiet. Look, Miss White, I wasn't as pure as the driven snow growing up, but I knew what I was doing was bad. And let me tell you, being sent to a borstal was a big old lesson for me. And like a lot of others, the war was my ticket out.
You've done well, Jim. I know people in the village like you and Rose very much, and of course everyone loves Susie.
I hate my name, Miss White. I hate the Mackey family. Terrible thing to say, but I hate them.
Forgiveness is the most difficult of journeys, Jim. Don't be hard on yourself. Eleanor sipped tea that was now lukewarm.
And you know how they get away with it.
Jim Mackey once again leaned forward, elbows on the table.
They pull strings as far up as the government. And they pull them hard.
How do they do that, Jim? I mean, I can appreciate it's a way to control how things turn out, but how does a family like yours get into government?
I reckon you can guess, Miss White. After all, it's what goes on everywhere. It's why you had a place to bring us for a few days. It's why you know how to use that gun of yours. It's always down to who you know. And who that someone knows, and then they know another someone who knows a secret. And one secret leads to the next, and before you know it, a piece of work like my dad has got the Prime Minister by the... Well, you know what I mean.
The Prime Minister?
Wouldn't surprise me. He pulls strings that go a long way and don't let's even talk about the police.
Eleanor pressed her lips together, her thoughts racing back over the past few weeks.
Jim, does the name Peregrine Gordon Williams ring any bells?
He shook his head.
Not a name that I ever heard mentioned, but remember, I've been the black sheep of the family for a good while now, even before we came down here.
He touched his face.
Well, I was out of the family until they needed me.
Eleanor shrugged.
What about the police? There's a lot of straight ones, but a good number of them are as bent as 9 bob notes.
He lifted his left hand and rubbed his thumb against his 2 forefingers.
Money talks in all sorts of ways, and the Mackies will pay to make a profit.
Yes, that's what I was afraid of, said Eleanor.
But remember what I said. It's what they know about the police that gives them power. If a copper is seeing someone who's not his wife, and one of my dad's people finds out about it, that's another one in the net, landed like a dopey fish. A copper might be found in a well, let's say, a tricky position, and that sort of thing becomes knowledge for the family, and there's power again. They're like the sort of worm that works its way into a wooden house. One starts nibbling, and before you know it, there's loads of them chomping away and the house falls down. See what I mean? That's how knowledge works, and my dad is a master of it.
He shook his head, fatigue curving his shoulders forward as if to protect his heart.
I was in the army, so I'm not silly. We all know what the intelligence boards do. But let me tell you, all this intelligence lark works on the other side of the law too.
Jim Mackey stared at Eleanor.
So, I reckon crime is like war. Or war's a crime. Sometimes I wonder which way the wind blows.
Eleanor took a deep breath. There was more she wanted to know, and though she was tired and Jim seemed exhausted, he was in full flow, as if with every word he was cleansing darkness from his soul.
Tell me about your aunt.
About Elsie Finch. Jim rolled his eyes and smiled.
You've asked about her before, haven't you? You know, I'm really fond of Auntie Elsie.
He sat back in his chair, more relaxed.
She's had a lot to put up with, I reckon. My dad and his brothers watch out for her well enough, but they expect her to be the one to make sure my granddad is looked after. I always thought she had more going on upstairs than they gave her credit for. It was always Elsie do this and Elsie do that, and she did whatever the boys wanted of her. I saw the same thing happening to my cousins, the girls, that is.
I think everyone must have been surprised when she married Abe Finch. Jim inclined his head as he regarded Eleanor.
You know about that as well. In fact, now I come to think about it, you know a lot about my aunt.
Don't get angry, Jim, said Eleanor. I too have to know who's around me. I saw Rose crying outside your house when your brothers came the first time, so it made sense to find out a bit more about who your brothers were. I didn't know you very well then, and I probably don't know you well enough now, but I always looked forward to seeing Rose and Susie when I walked into the village. I didn't like what was happening to you.
Sorry I jumped there, said Jim. I'm just edgy.
He smiled.
I don't know if there's much more to tell you about my auntie. She has the same birthday as me, the 5th of May, so I suppose that's why she's sort of obsessed with the number 5. Loves it. If she is a flutter on the horses, there has to be a 5 in there somewhere, and she's even more excited if the number is in the nag's name. When me and my brothers and cousins turned 5, she would throw us parties with balloons, cake and jelly. She really went to town, especially on my birthday, it being hers as well. We put it down to the fact that she didn't have any nippers of her own.
He shook his head and rubbed his eyes.
Anyway, she's got a few of her own little jobs going. It's just a bit of shoplifting, to be honest. My dad and my uncles let her do what she wants, as long as she doesn't bring home trouble and they don't have to worry about Granddad. As for poor old Uncle Abe, well, they sort of tolerated him if he kept away from their business. I don't think they were sorry when he died. In fact, they were quite happy about it because she had more time for Granddad. Abe might have been small time as far as the brothers were concerned, but Aunt Elsie thought the world of him, and he loved her. You could see it in their eyes.
Eleanor looked up at the clock. I should leave now, Jim, and you must remain here until I let you know it's safer to return. I'll be in touch. Miss White, please don't worry, Jim. I have a feeling that whatever your family needs you for might well cease to be of importance soon enough. I would imagine getting you back to drive a fast motor car is becoming too much trouble for them anyway.
Drive a motor car?
Isn't that what you were sent down for in the first place? Driving a motor car away from the scene of a robbery?
Yeah, but there's plenty of blokes can do that.
Then what is it? Can you tell me?
Miss White, I became an explosives expert in the army. I'm only used to being behind the wheel of a doddering old tractor now, but you never forget how to blow things up. That was what I learned first. I went through all the training before I was transferred to bomb disposal because I had such a steady touch. Being good at making and laying explosives makes you better and more careful at handling the detonators when you're looking at one of them big German bombs. And though I say it myself, I was the best of the bunch. Came sort of natural to me. He leaned forward. My family wants me back because they're planning the biggest bank job in history. And the trouble is, since this last visit, I know all about it. That's why I lost my temper. Even if they get someone else because of my training and my previous, I'll be the one the police finger when they do their investigating, and my brothers made it clear the family wouldn't lift a hand to save me. They told me I might as well stuff my pride and get on with it, and if I did, they'd put the coppers onto someone else who would take the fall, because the boys in blue always want a swift solution, and most of the time they don't care if they get the wrong bloke sent down.
Eleanor did not rush her journey home to Shacklehurst. Before leaving Burwash, she placed a telephone call to Scotland Yard and left a message for Steve Warren to the effect that her neighbour, the one they had talked about, had received another visit from his brothers and that she had sent them on their way.
"Does he know what this means?"
asked Val.
"Yes, and you can tell him my neighbours are now staying with a friend of mine, so they're not at home. However..."
Eleanor ran the telephone cord through her fingers.
"However what, Miss White?"
"However, do let him know that I am expecting a visit from the family myself."
"All righty. All very cryptic, but I'm used to that. I'll give him the message as soon as he shows his face."
"Do you know when that might be?"
"You know DCI Warren, Miss White. That's like asking how long's a ray of sunshine. Mind you, I can tell you that just before he nipped out, I put through a call from his old mate, Sir Perry, so they could be lunching together, and that means he'll be gone for a while."
Charlie and Bob not there to talk to?"
"No, they're out working."
"Thank you, Val. Much appreciated."
Approaching the house, Eleanor took note of the black motor car parked just inside the turning to an adjacent field. Not outside the house, though, close enough for anyone to walk to her home. Well, it looks like I might have to deal with the man pulling the strings sooner rather than later. Eleanor said the words aloud, and as she heard the echo of her own voice, she felt her hands begin to shake and a frisson of alarm run through her. And his henchmen. Yet she smiled as another thought came to her.
Good. I could do with a dose of fear.